Hey good peeps, Pig City and the Global Village, they call me Bruce, and welcome to Whoop It Up with UMFM, our Summer of 22 miniseries spotlight on the Whoopenholler Folk Festival. The Whoopenholler Folk Festival takes place in a beautiful farm just outside of Portage la Prairie, August 27th and 28th. Full details at whoopenholler.com and all socials. Episodes can be found at umfm.com. 101.5 UMFM is a proud media sponsor. Episode number two, Scott Nolan. Scott Nolan is a veteran of the roots scene in Winnipeg and North America, releasing 8, 9 or so albums, including his latest, The Suburb Beautiful with Glenn Buhr, a book of poetry, a play, as well as emerging from COVID as a visual artist. His songs have been recorded by some of the biggest stars in Americana and folk, like Hayes Carl, Mary Goche, Corin Raymond, and the incomparable Watermelon Slim. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, thank you.
Well,
that all sounds really terrific, heard like that in one place, so thank you for that.
I can't do any of it, so that's my job to, that's where we go. This will be your first Whoopenholler Folk Fest, so how do you like to...
Yeah, at least that I remember.
How do you like to experience a festival for the first time? Do you concentrate on, I got to make a good impression and, you know, knuckle under and concentrate on your performance or, and, you know, the job at hand? Or do you like to soak it all in and get the atmosphere and bring that vibe to the stage?
Oh, I think I'm probably the former in the sense that I can't really camp and perform. I probably can't really camp. I mean, I could camp, but camping at a festival wouldn't be like camping to me. And I play it straight in the sense that I stay focused on the performance and that I'm dressed comfortably and feeling good, showered, all those things, you know. So it's a trade-off. I don't take the festival in as a, you know. I mean, I like to spend time and be a part of it, you know.
Right.
But it's hard. It's hard to do both things. And if I'm being honest, I've, in the years since I've kind of changed my lifestyle, I've only begun kind of going out to see music again at this period of my life. And it was something I all but completely stopped doing. And I kind of worried about it a little bit. And so I'm glad I'm doing it again. But I've kind of had to relearn it a little bit without alcohol and stuff. And
That is a surreal experience. I've gone through it myself.
Well, and also when you spend enough years performing, there is a certain part of you, I think, that gives up that easy access to being an audience. Like, I'm in an audience sitting on a workshop stage, and I'm, you know, so I'll be taking something in from that proximity, which is very moving and exciting, so I certainly get to experience it that way, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, I separate myself mentally. I was just saying recently when I met John Hammond years ago at the Winnipeg Folk Festival, we got to spend some time together, and I asked him for some career advice, which back then would have been the very beginning of my career. And he said, never be mistaken for your audience. You know, shine your shoes, look good, and make sure you walk up. People know that you're not there in the audience. You're there to... And it's actually always kind of stayed with me. It was interesting. So in part, I have to, you know, roll up the day of my show and then very often leave that night to go somewhere else. So
it's one show here, one show there. But when it comes to experience, we got a pretentious question for a non-pretentious artist. What makes the existential human experience your muse? As folk fests are all about people and folks, and a common thread in your songs is a person's perspective. You walk 3 minutes in somebody's shoes, or you take us for a walk in yours.
Yeah, it's always been, from my first record onward, a source. It started a lot with my family, because there are a lot of characters right there. And I think by the time I began really investing in writing, I realized there was so much there. You know, it's like a drawing. Can you close your eyes and describe your grandmother in a paragraph? And when I try to do certain things like that, I realize, wow, it's a colorful character here, and I could spend a long time just kind of mining that territory. And then when I traveled early in my career, I wrote about where I was, usually American cities. And then when I slowed down and came back to Winnipeg and stayed put for a while, I began writing about this adopted city of mine. And so it all kind of, I mean, that's, I guess, the folk. Meeting Mitch Podolak many years ago, that's how we kind of connected. I was like a heavy metal kid, and he was a hippie communist folk guy. But he didn't try to kind of indoctrinate me into the music necessarily, the way I've heard other people suggest that he did with them. With me, it was really conversational and not even political. It was really just, I think he helped me kind of understand the folk ideology just for life in general, whether you were an artist or not. And it stuck in my head and helped me grow in some important ways, I think.
That's very true of Mitch. He is who he is, at the festival, off the festival, in the office, in the home, and
everybody. And like those members of my own family, very authentic. There's no kind of grooming them to fit your ideal remembrance. You got to take it all, and when you do that, you realize the significance and weight that it had, and how and why it operated in a certain era. It's amazing stuff. That's the folk ideology, right? It's why we have these events.
People and music, the people come first, for sure.
Yeah. He showed thousands of people that they could do it. And I don't just mean people like me, I mean people like the Whoopin' Holler go, oh, you know what? Mitch, you know, showed everybody they could do this. That was kind of his thing. He didn't want to be the guy that kind of kept the secret to himself. He wanted to show everybody, hey, you can do this, go ahead and do this. And that's a really cool, generous, that's the folk thing. Instead of it, vote for my song, save my record, pledge me for this, how about, you know, champion the person beside me? And if you already have an audience, why not share with them the stuff that you love? And like, for me in my career, truly everything that's ever happened of any kind of significance has been the generosity of some more successful artist. I'm a small timer, and some of these bigger artists talk about liking my stuff, and you can't imagine the equity that comes from that. And that's a really cool thing, you know. And it doesn't depend on the music industry or any kind of handshake deals. It's just kindness. I mean, how cool is that?
Well, let's talk about, let's take a quick aside and stop talking about you and talk about a couple of gentlemen that are very kind, like two of them, the most wonderful people I've ever met that have been a big part of your life, Big Dave McLean and Al Simmons.
Oh, yeah, sure. I see them both semi-regularly here at my house, which is amazing. I mean, most people, I realize, might not know what it feels like to have Al Simmons drop by. I mean, in the case of Al, he works out in my studio on his own projects, and I enjoy hosting him here because I love the guy, and Big Dave will wake me up any given morning to make coffee and visits. It's amazing. It's and these guys kind of started those early festivals. They were the ground zero for big festivals like Winnipeg and stuff like that, you know, and now here I am. I think of Harvest Sun. I've played their festival from the very beginning, when we were on hay bales with like a barn door for a stage and stuff. And so it's amazing to me to think, oh, geez, I'm inching toward being one of these lifers.
That comes with a different sense of comfort, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice kind of healthy pace to grow at, I think. Freddie Gilsmith told me in the early of my career when I was traveling with him, he said to me, he always said interesting things to me that were really, really resounded in the grand scheme of the music business. And one early on was, he said to me, you know, when I'm dead and gone and you put my career on a graph, it'll just be this subtle, slow, steady build. And it's kind of what it's been for him. We never hear enough about him to get sick of him. His songwriting always stays so great. It's kind of the right mix. And it allows you to kind of grow in a certain kind of harmony with the rest of it. And so you can make sense of it and not lose your head, you know, and learn how to save your money and all these kinds of things, you know. And I was lucky to be around, you know, Fred and Willie P. Bennett. To get to be around guys like that when I was starting out was like, I'd begun kind of showcasing like a lot of my peer group, and then I had this opportunity to just travel around and go trial by fire, and it was amazing. It happened so fast, kind of intense, and everybody was so good. I mean, I remember seeing Hayes, Carl very early, or Fred, or Sam Baker, these guys, their storytelling alone was, you could take the music right out of the show, and the stories alone were so incredible, and I thought, oh my God, you know? I hadn't considered any of these things yet.
And yet, and this is exactly how the young performers talk about you and Del Barber and Sweet Alibi. You know, it's
wonderful to know. I mean, in my case, that's why, because I had the great fortune of somebody else just giving me the time of day, frankly. And
speaking of growth. You have really grown as an artist, not just, you know, from a musician to a well-renowned a songwriter, but you've also moved into other mediums. And then there are a couple of artists. Well, Vivian Thompson, a landscape artist from Pinawa, has always maintained that if you can create in one medium, you can create in any medium. And Kay Stone, who used to be a professor at the U of W and is a writer, wonderful woman, she says, everything in your dreams is your own creation. And even if you can't paint, the paintings in your dreams are your creation. And I just like you to talk about growing into other mediums.
Well, I learned from renovating my 100-year-old house here. What I learned was if it rains hard enough, the water finds a way in. And I think that's another kind of truism for me. The moving around has always been a response to kind of crisis and inconvenient life circumstances. So the poetry was an immediate reaction to, I knew I had to quit smoking. I didn't mean to smoke in my 30s, and then I did. And I thought, oh my God, if I don't quit at 40, then I'll never quit. That's it. If I don't do this now, I'm going to be like pulling down the little breath tubes to take a cigarette guy, you know. And so I knew I had to figure out a way to do this. And I planned to get up the next morning and walk 10 kilometers. That's all I knew. But I knew I could not smoke a cigarette. And that first day, a poem came to me as I walked. And eventually I'd have to stop and type it into my phone. And by the time I no longer thought about cigarettes at all, I had a manuscript just like that. I remember my girlfriend at the time saying, when did you write this? And I thought, I don't know. I don't know, you know, but it was a response to this struggle and like a strange gift. And then, barely a week prior to the pandemic, that same relationship ended after many years, and the pandemic struck. We were all stuck at home, and I just, again, I'd found myself in a bit of a crisis and existential crisis, I suppose. And I had a National Geographic on the table in front of me, and I broke the spine and I pulled the staples. And for the next, I'd say 250 days, I produced 3 to 8 a day. And I began sharing them a lot. And I got responses early on from people that were also struggling. One lady wrote me from British Columbia and said, I look forward to getting up in the morning and I go look for your collage for the day. And I expand it on my laptop screen and I drink my coffee and I really take it in. And I was so moved by that it was doing something. Again, I thought of the things Mitch taught me, the real folk ideology. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm gonna try to do one of these a day till this pandemic is over. I just figured it was something I could contribute that was, I knew was doing a lot of good for me. And so again, when by the time the pandemic ended, I have a book and a publisher that are we're kind of in the later stages of putting out a book of these collages. And it's you know, my whole life has been that way, starting with music. Difficult adolescence, substance abuse issues, anxiety disorders. Art and music's just kind of saved my life. And now at 47, I know how to like take care of it back. Up until now, it's really just taken care of me. I've slowly begun to learn how to take care of it back and not fool around. It's not some frivolous thing to me now. I really balance it, and I consider what shows I take and why, and you know. So it's funny. It's what in a weird way I'm in this for my health, which is just kind of a strange thing, you know. Robbie Robertson from the band said the road is an impossible way of life, and I'm slowly getting to where like this is life, you know. Like it's, I think you got to flip it upside down somehow.
Somehow. And I want to ask you about your show, because you can rock it out, you can bring a tear, you can tell a story, and now with Glenn Buhr, you can get symphonic. what can fans expect from your show at Whoop and Holler? Can you throw us a bone?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to play certainly a good amount of these songs from the record with Glenn. And what's neat is, if you've heard the record, it's not really just like a roots guy with a string accompaniment. We really invested and collaborated and became very close friends. And so we spent 3 years working on this thing. And it's kind of a, you know, it's about my growing up in Winnipeg and the Charleswood neighborhood, and which is where its title comes from. And so, yeah, it was really kind of one of the broader, I mean, my last record, Silver Hill, I cut in 2 days in someone's backyard in Alabama. So this is kind of a real, but the core of it's still the same thing, which I kind of love about it. And so these shows, when I play solo, allow me to kind of show you the roadmaps of how it worked. And a good amount of the record, if not the whole thing, I'd created work tapes, which Glenn worked from, and some were kind of arrangements based on the work tapes, and other cases became much more collaborative, and Glenn would kind of expand what I'd done and create these really beautiful arrangements. And so yeah, the show's fun for me because I can kind of I can give you the broken down version of it. And yeah, it's I never even dreamt I'd get to do such an interesting, make such an interesting record with somebody.
It is very interesting. To me, it's right up there with Trains of Winnipeg, Clive Holden's album.
Oh, I remember Clive. Yeah, I love that record. And actually, somebody I've written with because of my collages. We kind of connected. I'd always enjoyed his stuff and known of it for some time, but we began actually writing because he'd remarked on some of my collage stuff, and I was, of course, very, very touched by him even acknowledging it. So, yeah, I love that Trains of Winnipeg, and I mean, you know, at that, like, I grew up in the city, born in Toronto, raised here, and like, I dug it up, man. Like, I found the old Blue Note on Main Street at 14. I was like a little kid, and I went looking for this stuff, and I found it, and it had such an effect on me to watch grown adults play music a few feet from me when I was that young and sound like an old record. So as a heavy metal kid that was like playing in garages and like, you know, it really was a massive musical epiphany for me, and it kind of shaped who I was and what I did. And so I think this record with Glenn is kind of, that's what I was aiming to capture, I suppose, was, you know, the band, outside of the classical and symphony musicians, the core band, Paul Balkane, Joanna Miller, and Gilles Fournier, I met all of them at the old Blue Note. Back by the time I was serving tables at the Portage location, I would lock up after hours and I would lure those musicians, hey, I'm writing some songs here. If I gave you guys some beer and stuff, you know, would you hang out and play some music? And so that's where I began. I couldn't pay musicians to do anything yet, so And the balloon, what I told them, I'm like, I'll keep track of the beer. And like, they're like, Scott, you go. Like, they gave me that place to, like, my rumpus room. And it was like, that was the start. Like, a real, true home base. And then, of course, my whole 30s, every Wednesday night at the Bella Vista. And the times change, too, is a very important. So these three rooms, I mean, man, that's, and again, it's in that record, or at least the intention of it is in there.
Well, thank you, Scott Nolan, for joining us for Whoop It Up.
My great pleasure.
yellow, lights them all right.
And thank you for tuning in to Whoop It Up with UMFM. Check out all episodes at umfm.com, all festival details at whoopandholler.com, and please join us in person August 27th and 28th. Until we meet again, be good, have fun, stay motivated.